Well, as I said then, our prayer command this evening is found in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 6. Pray to your Father who is in secret. And I suppose the distinctive thing about this text, the thing that you cannot possibly miss, the thing that strikes you between the eyes, is this. It is commanding the practice of praying on one's own, of praying by oneself. And not only is it doing so, but it's doing so, of course, in the context where, on the face of things, praying in the presence of others actually is presented negatively. So that I suppose you could read this passage and jump to this conclusion that Christians then should only pray by themselves and they should not pray in the presence of others. Here we've been commanded to pray in private. Praying in the presence of others is viewed somewhat negatively here. Surely then we may infer that Christians should pray in private rather than in the presence of others. But of course, after a moment's reflection, you realize that it can't possibly be saying that. I mean, only three verses later, we have our Lord's example prayer, which begins, "Our Father in heaven," not "My Father in heaven." It's clearly a prayer that is intended to be said in a corporate context. And then we have all those examples, don't we, in the book of Acts, of prayer being carried out, again, in a corporate setting. So Acts 1 verse 14, it's between Jesus' ascension and Jesus' outpouring of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost. And what are the disciples doing during that interim period? Well, we read there of them gathering together and together praying. Very significantly in Acts 2, 42, the outpouring of the Spirit at Pentecost has just occurred and 3,000 people have been converted to Jesus Christ. And of course, it's so important to notice, isn't it, what happens next. And these new converts don't just kind of drift off and live their lives separately now that they're Christians, but they come together in a church there in Jerusalem. And remember, that church is described for us in Acts 2:42, and its four main characteristics, or its four main activities, are spelt out for us there. What did that church do? What do New Testament churches do? What are the non-negotiable features of a New Testament church? Four things. The apostles' teaching, coming under the teaching of the Word of God. Fellowship. The breaking of bread, which I take there to be the celebration of the Lord's Supper. And what's the fourth thing? Prayer. And it's, as I say, very much in this corporate context. This is what the church does, not what the individual believer does. This is what the church in Jerusalem did. They devoted themselves, along with those other three activities, to praying. Well, then you have Acts 4, 24. We read this earlier on. Peter and John had their first skirmish with persecution, a night in a prison cell. And they then are released and go back to their Christian friends. And they prayed together that prayer that we read earlier on. Acts 12, famously, Peter is in prison again. But this time it's more serious and it's looking inevitable that he's going to be executed. And again, what are the Jerusalem Christians doing? They are gathered in one person's house, and together, we're told in Acts 12:12, they are praying. And there are other examples as well to which we could go in Acts. Indeed, I think we could go further and say that actually you would struggle to think of another New Testament passage that teaches about prayer where it is explicitly talking about individual prayer, private prayer. Or even perhaps another New Testament passage which most naturally read, even if it doesn't explicitly mention what type of prayer it's talking about, which would naturally read as a treatment of private prayer. The New Testament writers just instinctively think corporately, don't they? And that's the same whenever they write about prayer. So I'm saying then that this passage cannot be teaching us tonight that we should forget praying, publicly praying corporately, and we should only pray in private, because the rest of the New Testament is so against that conclusion. So it raises the question then, well, if it doesn't mean that, how should we understand this passage? Viewing praying in the presence of others somewhat negatively, and yet commanding private, individual prayer. Well, I want to put it to you in this way. This is perhaps, I think, a summary of the teaching of our passage. That the prayers we offer in public are probably unhealthy if we are not also engaged in a good deal of private praying. The prayers we offer in public are probably unhealthy if we are not also engaged in a good deal of private prayer. And let me flesh that out then in three areas. First of all, this evening, praying by oneself tests what we want. Praying by oneself tests what we want. Look at the people then that Jesus describes in verse 5. What is it then that those people want when they pray? These people who love to stand and pray in the synagogues and at the street corners. What is it that these people want when they pray? Well, Jesus says quite explicitly that they may be seen by others. These people want human praise, human applause, human admiration, human approval, human congratulation. That's what these people want when they pray. And I suppose the question for us is that just an issue for Jews in Jerusalem in the first half of the first century? And I think the answer probably is no, it's not, is it? Is it not always an issue for us as Christians in the whole area of praying in public, praying in the presence of others? Listen to what Don Carson says. He says, "What do I think about when I am praying in public? Am I so busy scrambling to find expressions pleasing to my fellow worshippers that I am not really concentrating my attention on God and scarcely aware of his presence, even though he is the one to whom my prayers are nominally addressed?" Now, I don't want to discourage or deter anyone this evening who perhaps only occasionally does pray out loud in a prayer meeting, or perhaps is just starting to do that, and you find that it's a very daunting thing, and you find perhaps that just the sheer nervousness that you feel, that kind of prohibits you from fully sensing the presence of God in the way that Don Carson is talking about there. I'm not trying to get at you this evening in any way whatsoever. And I would encourage you to keep on praying in those contexts, and hopefully the nervousness will begin to lessen over time, and it will be easier to fully engage with the presence of God and with who it is we are praying to as you do so. So I'm not wanting to discourage and deter anyone who just finds it a very, very nervous thing to do, to pray in a prayer meeting. But I suppose I'm challenging those of us perhaps who pray more often in these contexts. And isn't it true that it's a danger for us that we can just be, as he Carson says, scrambling for words that will impress and please our fellow worshippers, those who are in the meeting with us, rather than truly sensing the presence of God. And what's the test then? What's the test whether I just want human praise when I pray in those contexts? Or whether I am truly, sincerely praying to God? Well, I think this is a test. Do I also pray a lot in private? Because in private, of course, there's not that possibility, is there, praying in order to impress other people? In private, there aren't other people there by definition, of necessity. There's nobody there to impress. And so, if I'm praying a lot in private, then it's surely much less likely that when I come to pray in public, my motive is to impress those who are around me. And so, this is the challenge then. Yes, let's put a significant emphasis on praying together, praying corporately. That's so important. As we've seen, there are all these New Testament passages. But let's make sure that we are also, behind all of that, praying much in private. Because that's the test of what we want in our prayers. That shows that what we want is to communicate with the living God, not to impress our brothers and sisters. So that's the first thing, praying by oneself, it tests what we want. But then secondly, praying by oneself tests what we believe. Praying by oneself tests what we believe. So a week past Thursday, we had about 100 students from Emmanuel College come to our building here to look at it. On that day, they had visited some other religious buildings, and the other ones were probably a good bit fancier and more elaborate than ours. And so in the few minutes that I had to talk to the students, I kind of explained the why we have this simple and plain building. It's not because we simply because we couldn't afford something more elaborate when we built it, but rather it corresponds to the simplicity of our worship, the simplicity of our services, the simplicity of how we engage with God. And it seems to me that one of the great things about Reformed architecture and Reformed liturgy is that it forces us, doesn't it, to confront the issue, is God real? And is the gospel true? Because if God isn't real, and if the gospel isn't true, then we have nothing else to offer people, do we? There are no alternatives in our buildings and in our worship services. Because, of course, if the building's fancy, then even if God isn't real, and even if the gospel isn't true, then you can still enjoy the windows, and you can enjoy the furniture, and you can enjoy the panelling. If the service is entertaining, then again, even if God isn't real, and even if the gospel isn't true, you can still enjoy the jokes, and you can enjoy the music, and the drama, and whatever else may be there. But with Reformed Christianity, if God isn't real, and if the gospel isn't true, then we have nothing to offer. There's no plan B. There's no safety net. There's no alternative. There's nothing left if God isn't real and the gospel isn't true. And it's a bit similar to that, isn't it, when it comes to the business of praying by oneself. Again, this forces us to confront the issue, is God real? And not just does he exist in some vague sense, does he exist as some kind of distant, remote, impersonal concept, but is he so real that, as Jesus puts it here, he is in secret? Now, what does that mean where he says, your Father who is in secret? Well, he's not kind of describing God here as some kind of furtive God who kind of hides around in the shadows. He likes secret places. But the point is that you could translate it to your Father who is in the secret place. That when you go into that room, that ordinary room, and it's just you, he is there. He's that real. He sees you there. He is present there. He knows what you're saying. He's listening to what you're saying. He's a real, personal God engaging with you in your prayers. Praying by oneself forces you to confront that question. Is God that real? So real that he hears my every word as I'm there on my own in that room praying to him. And again, you see, if God isn't real, then praying by oneself has nothing else to offer, does it? There's no other reason for doing it. There's no other reason to go into that room by yourself for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever it may be. If God isn't real, it's a complete waste of time. But, you see, when it comes to praying in public, when it comes to praying with other people, then, really, even if God isn't real, you've got the opportunity to impress others, as we've been saying, and to kind of boost your own ego a bit, and attract admiration by the sheer eloquence and fluency of your prayers. And, again then, my question this evening is this. Do you believe that God is real? And you say, well, yes, we're here tonight at a worship service. But what's the real test that you believe that God is real? It's not the real test that you believe that God is real praying by yourself. Going into that room and praying by yourself, when there's no other incentive apart from the sheer reality of God to do what you are doing. You're not impressing anybody. There's nobody there to see what you're doing. The only incentive for going into that room and shutting the door is that God is real and he's going to hear what you're about to say. You pray by yourself. Again, not deterring corporate prayer. It's vital. Absolutely vital. But the test that we believe God is real is not found there so much as it's found on those occasions when we go into our room and pray by ourselves. So praying by oneself, it tests what we want, it tests what we believe. But then thirdly and finally, praying by oneself tests what we choose. Praying by oneself tests what we choose. So the public praying then that Jesus talks about here, you'll notice it's in two particular contexts. It's in the synagogues, he says, there in verse 5. So that would be formal liturgical occasions, mostly on the Sabbath. That's when, of course, particularly Jews gathered at the synagogues. And then the other context is on the street corners. And almost certainly then that's a reference to when the trumpet would sound to mark the afternoon temple sacrifice every day there in Jerusalem. And when that happened, when the trumpet sounded to mark the time of the afternoon temple sacrifice, people would drop everything and they would pray. They would look toward the temple and they would pray wherever they were, even on the street corners. So you'll see then that in both cases, the prayer is kind of externally constrained, isn't it? It's in response to something outside of the person. The weekly meeting at the synagogue on the Sabbath, or the daily sounding of the trumpets in the streets and squares of Jerusalem. So neither of those the types of praying in the synagogues and the street corners, neither necessarily indicates that the person has a high view of the sheer importance and necessity and indispensability of prayer. Because the people are doing it in response to something outside of themselves. It's been arranged by other people that prayer should happen at that moment, and they're responding to that. So in neither case does it necessarily indicate a sense within the person of the sheer importance and indispensability of prayer. But of course the prayer that Jesus described in verse 6 is different, isn't it? This is an unconstrained choice to go into your room and pray. I don't think that this is because the trumpet has sounded outside. Because at that point in the day, you wouldn't be in your house. You would be outside on the street corners. So this is a freely chosen activity. This is simply the initiative of the prayer, not constrained by the fact that there's a synagogue service happening or the fact that a trumpet has sounded, but it's simply my initiative. I want to go and I want to pray to God. And so it does indicate a sense in that person of the importance of prayer, the priority of prayer, the necessity of prayer. I ask you then this evening, do you choose to pray? You choose to make a cup of coffee, you choose to turn on the TV, you choose to check your Facebook page. Do you choose to pray? And again, what's the test of that? Well, the test isn't so much praying here on a Wednesday evening, again, important as that is. Because that's not your initiative. That's fitting in with the NREC policy of having a Wednesday night prayer meeting that somebody 20 years ago decided would happen every week. The test as to whether you choose to pray is whether you do this, as described in Matthew 6:6, and whether you go of your own accord, of your own volition, of your own initiative, whether you go often into a room and pray to God, unconstrained, undictated, unforced, just doing it because you feel that prayer is so absolutely important. And so let me reiterate once more this evening that I'm not discouraging corporate prayer. It is a feature, a characteristic feature of New Testament churches that they pray together. And if anything, it has then the biblical priority over the kind of prayer that Jesus describes in Matthew 6:6. But I say again, as I said at the start, that our public prayers are probably unhealthy if we are not also engaging in much private prayer. Because private prayer tests what we want, that we really want to communicate with God, not impress other people. Private prayer tests what we believe, that we really believe God is real and is attentive to what we are saying in some little bedroom somewhere. And private prayer tests what we choose because it's unconstrained. And it shows that we simply value and sense the importance of prayer. May God help us in this business of private prayer. Amen. We're going to close singing.